Welcome to the Federal Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federal Society's Criminal Law and Procedure Practice Group, was recorded on Thursday, June 15, 2017, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members.
Welcome to the Federalist Society's telephone conference call. This afternoon, we'll hear about legislative clemency. My name is Laura Flint. I'm the Deputy Director of Practice Groups here at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Today we are happy to have with us Margaret Love of the Law Office of Margaret Love and John Malcolm, Director of the Edwin Meese Center for Legal and Judicial Studies, and Ed Gilbertson and Sherry Lindbergh Gilbertson, Senior Legal Fellow at the Heritage Foundation. He's also the Chair of the Criminal Law and Procedure Practice Group here at the Federalist Society and will be moderating today's discussion. I will turn it over to John Malcolm to get us started. After opening remarks, we'll go to audience question and answer. Thank you for speaking with us, John. The floor is yours.
Terrific. Thank you very much, Laura, and thank you very much for people for listening in. So with the abolition of the federal parole system, this has put a strain on the clemency and pardon process. In historical terms, the pardon power has been used less often, some would say underutilized, by recent presidents compared to past presidents. This held true under President Obama, although he made far more use of his power to grant clemency than many of his predecessors. In total, he commuted 1,927 sentences. That's the largest number by any president since Harry Truman. Then again, he also received more clemency and pardon requests than virtually all of his predecessors. President Obama granted 5% of the nearly 37,000 applications that he received, the same percentage as George H.W. Bush, and in fact far less than the 12% that Ronald Reagan granted. So again, some people criticized President Obama for going too far with respect to clemency, while others criticized him for not going far enough. The American Law Institute recently approved a revision of the sentencing articles of the Model Penal Code, the first such revision in 60 years. The revised Model Penal Code includes provisions intended to reduce the need for executive clemency by providing more authority to courts to reduce prison sentences in certain circumstances and by granting them greater authority to relieve some of the collateral consequences that convicted felons face. Here to discuss these developments today is Margaret Love, a graduate of Yale Law School with a master's degree in medieval history from the University of Pennsylvania. Ms. Love's practice focuses primarily on executive clemency, sentencing policy, and the restoration of rights, areas of law she knows a lot about. In addition to being the co-author of a treatise on collateral consequences of a criminal conviction, she is the executive director of the Collateral Consequences Resource Center. She also knows the Justice Department extremely well. From 1979 to 1988, she served in the Office of Legal Counsel. From 1988 to 1990, she served in the Associate Attorney General's Office and in the Deputy Attorney General's Office. And from 1990 to 1997, she served as the United States Pardon Attorney. Margaret, let me turn the floor over to you.
Thank you so much, John. That's a wonderful, generous introduction, and I think it is a fitting doorway into the issues that I'll be talking about today. I admit to having been a bit frustrated at the extent to which the federal sentencing system seemed to rely on the clemency power to make any sort of adjustments. And when I was pardon attorney, one of the things that I tried to do was to call attention to the need for legislative reform. It seemed to me that there was entirely too much reliance placed on clemency, perhaps unwittingly, when Congress enacted the Federal Sentencing Reform Act in 1984. Who knew that the truth in sentencing determinant model, no parole, would turn out to be just a little bit too inflexible, particularly when coupled with very long mandatory minimum sentences? So as it worked out in the federal system, there was more and more indication that sentences that had been imposed perhaps decades before were a bit too strict. And the only mechanism, seeming mechanism, to adjust them was executive clemency. So I was particularly pleased when the American Law Institute launched its model penal code project in 2001. It is perhaps the longest running of all the ALI projects, and it was just concluded about 2 weeks ago, so there was a great sigh of relief on the part of the reporters. I was particularly interested in the provisions of the Model Penal Code that address precisely those issues that I found troublesome when I was pardon attorney. That is, what do you do in order to adjust a sentence, a proper sentence, a valid sentence, years later when circumstances have changed? That's one area that I want to talk about a little bit in detail today. The other area also implicates the pardon power, and that is the need to deal with the post-sentence collateral consequences of conviction, what used to be called civil disabilities, but increasingly are being seen as rather more punitive and rather more linked to the sentence, frankly, than the old civil disabilities, which mainly dealt with civil rights such as the right to vote, sit on a jury, and hold public office. Now collateral consequences is pervasive in the system and pervades all areas of civil life. In any event, let me go back and address the sentence modification provisions. There are basically three mechanisms in the Model Penal Code that serve to adjust a sentence imposed by the court and made final. One is the familiar notion that any prisoner should be able to earn good time credits. This is more of a routine sentence reduction authority, if you will, not simply for not getting into trouble, but perhaps for affirmatively engaged in programming to demonstrate a desire for rehabilitation and to change their life and to ready themselves for the time when they are released from prison. There's no question that many of the people who were engaged in this Model Penal Code project came from the federal system, many federal judges, many federal practitioners. So having an eye to the federal system was always there, although the lessons from the state systems were also very important. So the good time provisions are considerably more generous than those in the federal system. The second authority has an analog in the present federal system, and that is the authority for a court to reduce a sentence where a prisoner's circumstances have fundamentally changed. This in the federal system is known as compassionate release, but the Congress that gave courts this authority, indeed that antedated the Federal Sentencing Reform Act, they intended courts to have authority to reduce a sentence on motion of the Justice Department whenever circumstances had changed so much that it seemed like justice would only be served by reducing the sentence. The paradigmatic basis for an adjustment of sentence was old age or extreme illness. The authority in the federal system has been rather sparingly applied by the Justice Department. Only a few motions are taken back to the court every year. But the Model Penal Code drafters thought that this should be used more generously. In fact, they take the government in the form of the prison system out of the gatekeeper role so that prisoners can always have ready access to the courts. to make the case that their circumstances have so fundamentally changed that it is unjust to keep them in prison. The third sentence reduction authority is known as second look. This is a very unusual authority. Very few states have this authority, and certainly the federal system does not. This is where clemency functions. It is an authority for prisoners to return to court to seek a reduction of their sentence after a specified number of years. The model penal code indicates that 15 years ought to be ample time for prisoners to have served a sentence and have the ability to go back to court and make a case that they really ought to be resentenced. It's a full resentencing authority. For those on the call who are familiar with President Obama's very generous commutation program, this is pretty much exactly what he was doing. After a certain number of years, a resentencing. And I think that's the way it all worked out under President Obama's program. In fact, the U.S. attorney community seems to have been pretty much in charge of deciding which prisoners ought to be resentenced, and they were resentenced through the clemency program. I don't want to go into a lot of detail about that. I've just written an article about it, and Paul Larkin has also. But I can say that the Model Penal Code drafters and the provisions that are in the new Model Penal Code would put the court in the authority for making those decisions, which is a more regular and reliable way of handling sentence reduction. So that is the package of sentence reduction authorities that the Model Penal Code offers. It would be my fondest wish that Congress would look at it, although the MPC is mostly intended for the states. I think it has tremendously important applications in the federal system as well. The second group of issues that I wanted to talk about also implicate the extreme pressure that's been placed on the clemency mechanism, and that has to do with collateral consequences. John mentioned that President Obama had granted over 1,900 applications for clemency. Several hundred of those were applications for full pardon. And that is an area that has become a very important, although little used, mechanism for relieving federal offenders from some of these lifelong disabilities. Interestingly enough, the states have been legislating in this area quite actively, but they are sort of fumbling around for a useful, reliable mechanism for dealing with collateral consequences. The federal model has not moved at all from clemency. The Model Penal Code goal is to put that authority in the courts, just like the authority to control sentences, the authority to control collateral consequences ought also to be in the court. There are several pieces to the Model Penal Code framework. One has to do with setting standards through a sentencing commission. Standards that would guide courts in considering motions by federal offenders to relieve collateral consequences. The courts would have this authority in two ways. The first authority would come as early as sentencing itself, particularly if there was no prison term involved. If there is a collateral consequence that would perhaps limit a defendant's ability to keep their job or to keep their housing, this would be an area that the court could step in, would have authority to step in to relieve a particular law that was going to have a disabling effect on the defendant, perhaps limiting his ability to rehabilitate himself in the community. So even as early as sentencing, courts would have this authority. The second time that courts would have this authority would be after the sentence had been fully served, at a point where a defendant had demonstrated rehabilitation and remained subject to a variety of very restrictive collateral consequences. This is where the court would step in and function as, in effect, a partner. There is a model for this in the old model penal code, 1962. There, too, the court had the ability to, after a period of time, 5 to 7 years then, and 5 to 7 years in the current code, to issue, in effect, a certificate of rehabilitation, a certificate of restoration of rights. And this would demonstrate the court's determination that the person before them, no longer a criminal defendant, but someone who had fully served his or her sentence, could be restored to the full rights of citizenship that they lost upon conviction. This certificate would also have the salutary effect of reassuring employers and licensing boards and anyone else that had to deal with the person that they had been rehabilitated, that a court had found them to be rehabilitated, and that it was safe to deal with them, that they would not be held to a standard of negligence, having seen the certificate issued by the court. So this is a small-ish package of issues that I believe would take substantial pressure off the clemency mechanism. It would also, in the collateral consequences world, offer an alternative to what many states are doing, which is to enact expungement authorities. I have never been a particular fan of expungement. There has been a debate in the community for many years between the approach of forgiving and forgetting a conviction. I am of the view that forgiving is a better approach, particularly in a time when we have a tremendous amount of information available in many, many ways, so that expungement may, as a practical matter, not work very well. So the forgiveness model through the court that the model penal code offers is, I think, a great advance. It would be a very productive way to work in the federal system, it seems to me. But it would also offer a model for the states that would be reliable, accessible, and protect everyone's interest. It would protect those that had to deal with a person with a conviction. It would protect the government's interest, and it would protect the person who genuinely wanted, after having committed a crime, served their sentence, return to the community and live a productive life of full citizenship. So that's the package of authorities, and I think perhaps the best thing to do would be to see if John, you have any questions, and if those listening perhaps any have any questions at this point.
Sure. Well, thank you, Margaret. Laura, why don't you start to tee up some questions, and I'll I can get us started. Do you want to announce about turning on the floor mode?
Sure. Let's go to audience questions. In a moment, you will hear a prompt indicating that the floor mode has been turned on. After that, to request the floor, enter star, then the pound key.
Okay. I've got a couple of questions.
Go ahead.
So I've got a couple of questions to sort of get us started. So you talked about one concept of a fundamental change in a prisoner's circumstances, and you made reference to the compassionate release program, which you correctly noted is usually reserved for people who are quite elderly or who have a certified terminal illness. I get the impression that, that you and the drafters of the Model Penal Code would want to expand this in some way beyond those two limited categories, rather than just making a more robust use of the two categories that exist. And I'm curious, since you know you often hear that everybody finds God when they're in prison, and they use this as sort of a ruse to talk about their changed how they have a changed heart. How would you, if you are you in favor of expanding beyond just being elderly and or terminally ill? Are you in favor of expanding it? And if so, how? What's kind of your limiting principle?
Sure. Well, I do think that changed heart is probably not the kind of change that either the drafters of the Model Penal Code or, in fact, the drafters of the Federal Sentence Reduction Authority had in mind. However, there are other changes, extraordinary changes that were not contemplated at the time of sentencing that could be taken into account by a court. For example, and this is actually in the Sentencing Commission's policy that guides sentence reduction motions in the federal system, a change in family circumstances is one expressly included. In fact, it's even included in the Justice Department's own guidelines. If, for example, a prisoner has a minor child, and if caregivers for that child die or disappear or are unable to care for the child, this is a fundamental change in family circumstances is one that's recognized even in the Justice Department's policies as a basis for sentence reduction. I'm not sure that there has ever been a motion that the Justice Department has made to the court to reduce a sentence based on changed family circumstances, but it is one that they recognize, and the Sentencing Commission, when it developed its new policy last year, recognized it also. There may be other circumstances that reveal a true change in circumstances. The question of disability and illness is one that I think has been little used. I'm not talking about a minor illness, but I'm talking about one that is totally disabling or largely disabling. And if this sort of thing happens, it is at least important for the court to have an opportunity to decide whether the circumstances are so extraordinary and compelling, and that is the formula in the federal statute, that the sentence should be reduced and the person sent home. So those are the kinds of changes, not simply a change of heart. Although rehabilitation can be recognized, it's very specifically in the federal model not sufficient.
Let me ask you a second question before we turn to the audience question. So you talked about potentially giving a judge sentencing authority to relieve collateral consequences, and you tied it to somebody's ability to find housing or a job. I suppose it would be difficult to make an argument that serving on a jury or having the right to vote would be tied to housing or a job. But I guess one thing that occurs to me is that there are going to be certain collateral consequences that are imposed that many judges may not like. Becoming a registered sex offender, for instance, comes to mind. And I'm wondering whether how this scheme would play into statutory restrictions like that and what the limiting principle on a judge in terms of making these considerations might be.
Sure. And that's a very interesting example that you gave. Let me first say that there are a handful of states, New York most notably, that have given their sentencing courts this authority to relieve statutory consequences for many years. New York's courts have had that authority since the 1940s. or not 1940s, 1970s. They have another authority from the 1940s. The Colorado courts now have this authority, New Jersey. It's a very interesting concept. But the notion would be that courts could look at a particular individual, even one perhaps whose crime triggered an authority or a mandatory requirement that they register as a sex offender. There's been some interesting litigation in the states now, particularly, for example, involving juveniles whose offense is very minor and yet that trigger a registration, a lifetime registration requirement. So I would, even though this is probably a hot button area, I would say yes, the court's authority ought to extend to sex offender registration in the appropriate case. Now, in terms of elected judges, they probably would exercise this authority very sparingly, but there are those cases of the Romeo and Juliet crime where there may be an underage sex offense that technically would trigger a lifetime registration requirement. That's the kind of thing that I think that courts ought to have the authority to relieve, and in many states, in fact, they do have that authority.
Okay, well, Laura, I have other questions, but why don't we go ahead and see whether we can take some from the audience.
Again, to ask a question, please enter star, then the pound key on your telephone keypad. Oh, I don't see any questions right now.
Then let me ask another one, and we can see whether anyone picked it from that. So you talked about my colleague at Heritage, Paul Larkin. So one thing that Paul has also written about, and I'd be curious to get your view since you've been in this position, is that the pardon attorney should not be housed within the Department of Justice, because you end up getting very one-sided, or at least he posits, you end up getting very one-sided recommendations from people who actually prosecuted these individuals, who are having to come forward and say, perhaps we made a mistake. There's sort of almost an inherent conflict of interest in having the pardon attorney housed within the Department of Justice, and it might be better to have the pardon attorney placed, say, within the executive office of the White House. And I'm curious to get your views about that, and also whether you believed at the time that you had enough resources at your disposal to handle the influx of petitions that you ended up getting.
Oh boy, those are two interesting and important questions. For years, John, I argued when people said that the pardon attorney was, conflicted and that the authority ought to be moved out of the department. For years, I argued that it could remain in the department. The authority to make clemency recommendations was vested in the attorney general from a very, very early time in our history. When the Justice Department was established in 1870, the attorney general was the one that made the recommendations. In fact, President Lincoln's attorney general decided that the president was too soft-hearted and could not be trusted with the pardon power, and Attorney General Bates said, all people will now come through me in order to get clemency. It worked very well for over a century. In fact, and Paul, I think, recognizes this in his article, in fact, the U.S. attorneys in the early years were the ones that controlled clemency and literally controlled it, because they would make the recommendations in the first instance. They were the staff of the pardon attorney. More than half of the applications that came in were granted. So I don't think it is inevitable that that federal prosecutors are conflicted. History proves that they need not be. However, the fact is, in recent years, and this was my experience starting in the 1990s, it was very difficult in many cases to get the U.S. attorneys to approve a clemency request. I have come to believe that unless there's a fundamental change in the way that the department views clemency, that it really should be taken out of the department. One such fundamental change that might work, that actually was the way clemency used to work in the department, would be to put the Attorney General personally, as a cabinet member, in charge of making recommendations. That's the way the pardon program worked in the department until the end of the Carter administration. And at that time, the authority to make pardon recommendations, clemency recommendations, was delegated within the Department of Justice to the Deputy Attorney General. I have always argued that that was the beginning of the end of the pardon program within the department, since the Deputy Attorney General, as the Chief Executive Officer, if you will, or Chief Operating Officer of the department, is in charge of the federal prosecutors, is frequently a federal prosecutor himself or herself, and that circumstance, coupled with a very punitive mindset, I think, that informed the federal criminal justice system and created a kind of a culture of an unforgiving culture, if you will, those two things made it very difficult for the department truly to serve the president. And that's what it was always supposed to be from the beginning, that the pardon program and the Attorney General's advice to the president was supposed to serve the president. As it has happened in my experience and seeing it operate in the 16 or 17 years since I've left the department, it has seemed to me that the clemency program in the department served the department's interests and not the president's. I think that several presidents have experienced that. Bill Clinton certainly experienced it, and it was the occasion for his last-minute, I'm not even sure what the word is, explosion of clemency grants that did not come through the department and were not blessed by the department. George W. Bush experienced a similar frustration with the level of clemency recommendations that he was getting from the department, and in several cases, specifically ones that he was interested in, he had a very hard time getting a favorable recommendation out of the department. I would argue also, and I have in a recent article, that President Obama was not particularly well served by the department because the system that was set up for vetting the applications that he invited was one that almost certainly was bound to fail. So I guess I have come to agree with Paul that at this point it would be better to move the pardon program out of the department. How you set it up is, you know, a subject for a good conversation. Paul has proposed that the vice president be put in charge of the clemency program, and that the vice president be the one with a staff to make recommendations to the president. That's exactly the model that is followed in what I think is the most productive pardoning state in the country, which is Delaware. Both Delaware and Pennsylvania have a model whereby there is a board that is chaired by the lieutenant governor that makes binding recommendations, binding in the sense of they function as a gatekeeper for the governor, so that the governor cannot make a grant without the affirmative recommendation of the board. The governor doesn't always have to do it, but the governor can't do it without the board's recommendation. Now, that could be a model for the federal system. There are other models out there in the States that are quite interesting and could serve as a very good source of exemplar for a federal system if the president was so minded to make some changes in the way the system is set up. I hope that the president will. I think that it is tremendously important to have a system that the president can rely on. I also think that a system like that could be a great source of legislative recommendations to the president, so that part of the function of the person in charge of the pardon process would be to think of ways to steer business away and into the courts. I have written that I think that that ought to be pretty much half the job of the pardon attorney, is to think about ways to move business into more reliable, less political channels away from the president. So yes, I agree with Paul. I think at this point that it would be most productive to think of a better model. The model that Lincoln set up doesn't work anymore.
Great. Laura, anybody in the queue?
Not yet. Again, to ask a question, please enter star, then the pound key on your telephone keypad. Oh, let's go to our first question.
Yes, hi. Hi, John. Hi, Margaret. This is Bill Otis, again, to present something of a dissenting point of view by way of one initial observation, and then would ask your comment on three specific points, if I might approach it that way.
Absolutely. Hi, Bill.
Oh, hi, Margaret. How are you?
Good.
My overall question is this. The basic premise of our conversation today seems to me to be that there's something amiss in the way the public and the government is behaving, but nothing gets said suggesting that there's something amiss in the way the criminal is behaving, that all the responsibility lies with us. Nothing is said about the responsibility of the criminal who made his own choice, usually for purposes of greed, because he thinks that rules are for other people, and he wants a fast buck. That's certainly my experience in many years as a federal prosecutor. As to my three specific observations, and then if you want to, as I'm sure you will, make some observations, as to collateral consequences, the principal collateral consequence that I hear problems with are difficulties in obtaining employment. But those difficulties do not, it seems to me, stem from the conviction. They stem from the behavior that got the defendant his conviction, that a normal, rational employer is going to be concerned about someone who steals or who cheats other people out of their property or who's doing drugs. My second specific observation is that the discussion today about throwing things back in the court, often many years after the conviction has become final, which will thereby increase already overburdened courts with yet more litigation years after the basic facts occurred, is that it strikes me as an end run around the failure of the forces supporting leniency to get through Congress, first the Smarter Sentencing Act, and more recently the Sentencing Reform and Corrections Act. It's also not going to get through this year, and this just strikes me as, kind of maneuvering around that rather than accepting Congress's judgment that it doesn't want this. My final point is why there is an emphasis, as all of today's emphasis has been, on going easier on the criminal in the midst now, we're in beyond our second year of an increase in violent crime throughout the country and an increase in drug overdose deaths after 23 straight years of declining crime. We're going in the wrong direction now. And I wonder whether being concerned exclusively with leniency and how to increase leniency. That's just striking with me. It strikes the wrong note in light of our present problem, which is the increase in some cities, a dramatic increase in crime and drug abuse. And I'll be happy to listen to your comments.
Well, Bill, you may be surprised to hear that I completely agree with about 90% of what you said. To take your first point about, you know, not focusing on the unlawful behavior of the criminal defendant, I hope that it that you will believe me when I say that I did not intend at all to suggest that I was interested in being soft on criminal behavior. Not a bit. I mean, we have a system that that prosecutes and convicts and sentences very effectively, and it's properly so. I think what has been recognized by most people, perhaps you and I would disagree on this point, what has been recognized in many states and in the federal system, that the severity of the punishment, what is imposed at the front end when we're very angry at someone's behavior, in time, over years, becomes something that we look back on, many of us, and say, gosh, that was too much. We hit them too hard. I remember a conference a number of years ago when Doug Berman made a comment about how we always hit people too hard at the outset of a sentence. And I think that's why, historically, over time in our country, in the 19th century, we had a very operational and routine use of the pardon power to reduce sentences. And in the first decades, the first 80 years, I guess, of the 20th century, we had a parole release authority where after a certain period of time, a sentence imposed by the court would be routinely reduced. I don't think that many people are interested in returning to a parole system, but what they are interested in is somehow finding a way to replicate the system that, at least in the 19th century, was felt to be important when, over time, not because you were going soft on what the criminal had done, not because you thought that the court had done the wrong thing when it imposed the sentence, but after a period of time, many people, and I have, believe me, had many federal prosecutors come to bring cases to the pardon attorney who said, okay, enough's enough. We think we were too tough. So I'm just saying that that is an impulse that is in the system and that has been recognized for centuries, actually, too, by federal prosecutors. So that's one response that I would give. Let me say this about the collateral consequences issue. It's not that the court, in addressing collateral consequences under the new model penal code model, would be somehow excusing criminal behavior or forcing employers to deal with someone whose behavior in the past had indicated that they were not a very reliable person to hire. What the court's authority would do would be to remove a mandatory statutory bar. The employer might want to hire someone, but the law says you may not. To give the employer, for example, or the landlord or the licensing board, authority to consider an individual on the merits. And I think that is the only authority that would be given the court, to remove a statutory bar. The authority to issue a certificate of restoration of rights, again, is only addressing mandatory bars. There is a standard also in the model penal code draft that hopefully will help licensing boards and any discretionary decision maker make a sensible decision when looking at an individual. What did the individual do? How long ago did the individual do it? What's the individual done since? Now, no one wants to put a person convicted of fraud, particularly recently convicted of fraud or theft or any sort of crime of dishonesty, in a position where there is a risk that they would do it again. But if you posit, for the situation of a young person, maybe even a teenager, who was convicted of possessing drugs, maybe selling drugs, who 15 years later has long since demonstrated his or her good conduct and reliability, there's no reason that an employer or a licensing board should be barred from considering that person. And the last point that I would make addressing the current crisis in opioid use, I have been tremendously concerned about this personally. I think many, many people have. It seems to me that it is important for us to take this opportunity to address the problem of drugs as a health problem, as a public health crisis, rather than a problem that can be resolved through the criminal justice system. We tried that, Bill. It did not work. And I think you may disagree with me, but I believe that more and more people are coming to understand that the problem of drug use is not one that is susceptible of being dealt with through the criminal justice system. We've had a drug war for more than 30 years, perhaps 40 years, and we are still fighting. And we're still fighting the same fight that we started fighting 40 years ago. We have to be more sensible about this. And it may be that the problem of opioid addiction and fentanyl and similar kinds of prescription drugs is a better vehicle for reconsidering than, for example, crack cocaine or one of the drugs that led to extraordinary violence in the cities. So I hope that we will sensibly go forward and deal with drug sales and drug use as a public health problem going forward. But I completely agree with you that it is a terrible problem right now.
I don't want to take more than my time. I appreciate your answer, and I'll let it go with just one final observation, which is that my view, this drug epidemic is both a public health problem and a criminal law problem. You're right. We can't jail our way out of this drug problem, but incarceration is part of the answer, along with medical treatment and counseling. And the reason I say that is that there are pill mill doctors who make a whole bunch, most of it paid by the government. There are smack dealers out there who exploit and who make a great profit off of ignorance, misery, dependence, and eventually addiction. Those people, in my opinion, belong in jail, in addition to the other things that we should do. But I thank you very much, and someday you and John and I should all sit around and have a panel discussion of this at Georgetown Law.
I would love it, and thank you, Bill. Let me just say that you get no argument from me about the pill mill doctors, no argument at all.
Thanks very much, Margaret, and thank you, John.
Let's go to our next caller.
Well, the whole addiction problem with opiates is that it is illegal. It was never a huge problem when you get laudanum in a drugstore. It only became a problem when it was put in the hands of criminals as the only suppliers. Fentanyl is not a particularly desirable drug, and the reason for addiction is that when a person takes opiates, they reduce their own opiate supply that their body makes, and that makes the physical dependence. Now, there are drugs like Ibogaine, which can eliminate that physical dependence, but that's illegal in most states because it's because of this puritanical drug regime that we have that has its racist origins in trying to make it uncomfortable for Chinese immigrants to smoke in opium dens. So let's just legalize everything and let the market take care of it. And if people insist on destroying themselves through stupid drugs, let them do so. But opium is not necessarily, except the fact that it's illegal and that its suppliers are all criminals and that they have no qualms about sticking fatal doses of fentanyl into what would otherwise be a predictable drug dose that you get in a drugstore. For people who are in pain, the present regime of opium restriction for people who have chronic pain and who need painkillers, one of the mildest of which is marijuana,
can I ask if you have a question?
Yeah.
This is not about the drug war, this program.
Well, it's about, that's true. But the least discretion in sentencing comes from the fact that statutes have made it impossible for judges to show mercy.
If you could get to your question, I think that would be appreciated.
Isn't that the real problem? The drug war and the fact that statutes make it impossible to show mercy.
Well, there is a bit of a question there, I think, and I think it is that would greater flexibility in sentencing help or hurt the public program to manage, limit, control the use of unlawful drugs? And I think the answer to that is yes. It would also enhance justice in our system. I happen to believe that the courts are the most reliable dispenser of mercy, notwithstanding Alexander Hamilton comment that the president was. So I do think that more authority in courts would be extremely helpful.
A reminder, to ask a question, please enter star, then the pound key on your telephone keypad. Please try to keep them on topic. I'll make a brief announcement while we wait for our next caller. Our next Teleforum conference call is scheduled for tomorrow, Friday, June 16th, at the unusual time of 11 a.m. Eastern. And that call will be a Courthouse Steps Teleforum on Microsoft v. Baker, which was decided this past Monday, featuring Ted Frank of CEI. A reminder to keep an eye out for emails announcing upcoming Teleforum calls and to consult the full schedule of upcoming calls on the Federalist Society's website. Also available there are podcasts of previously recorded Teleforum calls you may have missed. Not seeing any more questions. John, do you have any more?
No, I think this has been a really terrific program. Obviously, there are strains on the system, and I will say that President Obama certainly highlighted this issue tremendously, and these are, look, I think that ALI's suggestions are always worthy of consideration, and they enhance a dialogue on matters that are of important public importance. And I want to thank Margaret for participating, give her an opportunity, obviously, to say any final words. But I will put in a plug as the chairman of the Criminal Law Practice Group that I would encourage those people who are listening who are not members of that practice group to please get involved. Margaret, I'll give you the final word.
Thank you, John, so much. The final word that I would suggest here would be that Congress take a serious look at the ways in which the criminal justice system could be made more fair and more reliable for all people. I think it's a tremendously important area. I have not seen an awful lot of progress in this area for some time. I also hope that the Justice Department will look at using the authorities that it does have, and that there will be more attention to both to recognizing changed circumstances and also the importance of figuring out ways to relieve collateral consequences. So that's my hope for the next few years, and the states seem to be doing a pretty good job, and it's my hope that the feds will follow them.
On behalf of the Federalist Society, I want to thank our experts for the benefit of their valuable time and expertise today. We welcome listener feedback by email at info@fedsoc.org. Thank you all for joining us. We are adjourned.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.